It's May 4th?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Friday, May 4th. I read this quote this morning. I can't remember it exactly, unfortunately, but it was from the Zen teacher Maizumi Suzuki Roshi. Something like, you need to be aware and present, or it wasn't that, but something to that effect of you have to be present in order to see things and people clearly, something like that. It wasn't present, but I don't remember what he said, but and it reminded me of how true that is and how often it applies to everything that I do and everywhere I go, and how often I forget or am not clear or present or whatever it was. So then I don't see people and things clearly. And a striking example came when I was in Ecuador, and we went on a long hike in the Andes, and the place where the inn where we were staying had given us a series of pictures, photographs on the trail that would indicate to us where we should go on the trail. We knew where we needed to go because we had agreed in the morning that a truck from the inn would come and pick us up at this place so that we didn't have to walk. It was already a 3-hour hike, added on to another part of the hike we had done to go to this lake and a volcano and everything. You know what I'm talking about, that place. So we knew where we had to go, and we had these pictures. It was a series of photos that they have that they give people that we thought, you know, we would just follow them. And the guy was supposed to pick us up at 4 o'clock in this village that we were supposed to go to. So we did the first part of the hike, walking all the way down to the bottom of this volcano, to this lake, which was fabulous. And then walking all the way back up, which was really intense because it's 3,800 feet up. I mean, the altitude is 3,800 meters. So already coming up was intense. And then we ate our picnic lunch that the inn had given us and started on our then return trip to where the truck would meet us. The truck had dropped us off, too, at this place. And for some reason, the pictures didn't correspond to anything we were seeing on the path. And we were like trying to say, okay, so maybe it's this. Do you think it looks like this? You know, and is that rock formation there? It just didn't really look right. And so, but we continued on, and every once in a while we would meet some other hikers, and we would say, ask them if they knew this village where we were going to. And they all said no, they'd never heard of it. But they were coming from the place where our inn was. They were coming from that direction. So we knew we were going in the right direction. And occasionally on the path there would, you know, like every, I don't know, 500, every kilometer maybe, there would be a sign pointing to this village where our inn was. But the place where he was going to pick us up in the truck was really tiny, so it wasn't even figuring on these signages. And it was beating down sun, like really hot sun. And you're on the equator, so the sun is super, super hot, and you have to be really careful. And it was like the first big hike we were doing. And so we were, of course, arguing with each other about, were we in the right place? Was this the right way to go? You know, just as you can imagine. And at some points, I realized, and my son realized, I don't know about my husband because he was like so anxious about the whole thing, but we realized that we weren't really even appreciating the walk. It's a beautiful hike. It was a fabulous randonnée, you know. But because we were so unsure and so much anxiety about, are we on the right path and we're going to get lost in the middle of nowhere and they never, you know, we're never going to get back, and, you know, we could have turned on our phones, probably our French phones, and activated the 3G, but they might not have even have been 4 3G there, you know, where we were. It was really like isolated. And as soon as we finally got to this place where another hiker, actually we saw two young, like, I think they were Dutch, two young men, Dutch hikers. And they had told us, oh, there's this place, you know, where there's benches and tea, and they'll explain to you where to go. We never saw that place. I think that must have been after where we left the path. And then, but then this other, like, maybe an hour later, another young woman came along, and I think she might have been American. And she said, yeah, just, you know, you see that ridge up there? You can see that little building? It's like a little hut, and there's someone there, and he can tell you, and I think it's there where you want to go, where you want to turn off the path. So when we finally got to that little hut, it took forever to get to that ridge, but when we finally got there, my son asked the guy in Spanish, and he said, yeah, you just go down this hill, you just go down here, and you'll get to the bottom of into the valley, and you'll see the village. But the village had two parts. There was like the haut and the bas, you know, and we weren't sure which one where we were supposed to meet the guy with the truck, because even that was kind of approximative communication. My son speaks Spanish, but, you know, we weren't really sure. But once we talked to that guy in the little hut, things eased up, you know, we kind of were like, oof. And it was so palpable how we could appreciate it in a different way. And that applies, I realize, that is the kind of thing that happens with not only anxiety or fear or doubt, but with other emotions too, or other opinions or positions or thoughts that are occupying my mind, which means that I don't really appreciate what's right here. I don't see things and people as they really are, because I'm preoccupied by something else. And the next day, just my son and I went on a long hike. And this time, they gave us like the same inn, gave us like this, you know, how do you say that? When it's plastified, you know, it's a piece of paper that's been laminated. Laminated. Yeah. That again had pictures, but it had little descriptions under the pictures. So it would say that. So go here, stay on the right side of the stream, you know, do this or that, whatever. Follow the fence, follow the barbed wire until it's not there anymore, and then, you know, go up to here and whatever. And also, everyone in the inn where we were, it was like family-style dining and the kind of thing where all the randonneurs talked at night together and share their stories and whatever. And several of the people who had done this walk before, the day before, had said, but you have to be really careful for the dogs, that there's dogs that come out onto the path, you know, and like are growling and snarling and barking at you. And everyone's advice was, you just you have a walking stick and you just point it at the dog and it will go away. And so the inn had these walking sticks and everything. And so, fine. So my son and I go off on this walk. And again, like, it was really hard to find the instructions. First of all, they weren't written by an English speaker, so it was kind of obscure language sometimes. And trying to interpret what they meant. And then it was this kind of thing that I've also seen a lot in Portugal, where they say, so you take this road and you'll come to a white house with blue shutters and a filling station next to it, and there's a road that turns right there. Don't take it. It's kind of, what? Why are you telling me this? Because then suddenly your attention is focused on this. So it would be like, so when you come through this little passage of trees, don't take the first path going up to the ridge. But it wasn't clear, like, which was the first path going up to the ridge. So at one point, we didn't take the path going up to the ridge, and we went off in another direction. And after, like, 20 minutes, we realized this was not going where we were supposed to go. So we go back, and we go up where we thought we weren't supposed to be going, but that's what it was supposed to be. Anyway, so it was confusing. Again, we were kind of anxious, but we had learned from the previous day that we should, as my son kept saying to me, that, Mom, you saw yesterday, every time we followed our intuition, you were right. And so I was like, he's right. You know, actually, every time we guessed, we thought this must be the way, we were right. So we tried to do that again, and then there were the dogs. And so we were really anxious about the dogs because people had told us these stories. And one of the two of the women who we talked with had said they had done it the day before, and they had said, oh yeah, it was like 5 or 6 times during the walk. The walk takes like 3 hours, you know, and 5 or 6 times these dogs would appear and snarl and big teeth and whatever. And so we were sort of like qui vive for these dogs all the time. And every time we would hear a dog bark, we would think, oh no, they're coming. And after the first time, so at one point the dogs did come, and it was quite intimidating, these little dogs. We just held our sticks, you know, and William had 2 sticks. And there was a lady on the hill, like a farm, you know, paysan, with the dogs. And one of the women at the inn had said to us, but the thing is, the dogs are always, they're not wild dogs. They're dogs that are there when there's civilization. So there's a farm, or there's a shepherd, or there's, you know, there's sheep, or there's, and there's usually a person with them. And they belong to those people, and they're just doing their job. You know, the dogs are just thinking they're protecting the territory or whatever. So here we were, like, again, worried about, are we on the right path? And are these dogs going to, when are the dogs going to appear? And getting caught up again in that. And so, like, again, not really appreciating the fabulous walk it was. So at one point, we decided to stop for lunch. Again, we had our picnic from the inn. We decided to stop for lunch in this beautiful forest. And both of us realized what was going on again and had, you know, this amazing conversation about it, which I think was related to the setting. You know, when you're out there in the middle of the forest on this fabulous walk, something also happens, you know, and we had this amazing, I can't even remember what we talked about, but we both were clear that it was this incredible conversation we were having about it. And by the time we then got up to this ridge, which they had warned us at the inn, you know, in the book of hikes you could take from the inn, it said, if you have any kind of vertigo, you should not do this hike. Because if you're like really high up on this ridge with a path like maybe that wide, and on one side it's, and on the other side it's, and I kind of, as I say, I don't officially have vertigo, but I don't really like heights. And I had said to the guy at the inn, you know, this, should I not do this? He said, no, you know, if you don't really have vertigo, then don't worry about it. But it was intense. And so by the time we got up there, we had been through our long discussion of just being present with what is and appreciating it regardless. And so although I was like tempted to like crawl on the path because on top of it, like there's wind. And so, oh my God, it was intense. And even in the middle of that, I could really appreciate it. Although I didn't, and my son was like, you know, wow, look at that, mom. You know, looking around, and I couldn't really look. And I thought of Peter Matheson in, I think it's The Snow Leopard, but it might be in the other book, I don't know, where he taught, you might remember this. Have you read this? You've read this book, so, yeah.
I recommended it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Fabulous book. And he's walking on this path in the Himalayas somewhere, and his boots are killing him. He, like, made the mistake of buying new boots before his trip. And he's got this big pack on him, and it's a tiny, you know, I imagined that it was a small trail like I was on. His was probably much more extreme, though. And on one side, it was like a sheer cliff up, and on the other side, it was a sheer cliff down. And I don't remember if there was snow or there were probably other elements involved. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he had kind of the same experience where the only thing you could do was just to concentrate on just one step after the other. Wasn't it something like that? Mm-hmm. And that's the only way to get through it. The only way was just to be focused on just this step. Because if he focused too much on this side, he could risk falling. You know, it's the kind of thing when you're doing Kinhin, and if you think about it, you kind of are unstable. Or if he was focusing too much on the other side, he would like bump into the cliff and then risk falling the other side, right? And so I had to just do that too. Just, I didn't crawl, but just one step at a time. And my son was like, you know, do you want to turn back, Mom? And I was like, are you kidding me? No, I can do this. It's no big deal. And I did. But I think it helped me that we had had this experience the previous day and earlier that day, and then we had had this conversation about it, to just really just be there and just be whatever you're doing, not being caught up by whatever the emotion is. And, you know, it doesn't even mean like you have to look around and say, oh, this is fabulous. It just means, or look around, oh, this is terrifying. It means just being there and just really being there, and then you could really appreciate it. And I'm glad that I had the previous day's experience and then the discussion with my son, because it really did help me when I was up there on that ridge that was terrifying at times. And there are so many instances when it happens, you know. We went through just terrible, terrible fog, too. I don't know if you experienced this when you were in the Andes, but because of the climatic conditions where there's so much heat, it's not like any other mountain range. You know, there's no snow, except on the volcanoes sometimes, but there's no snow at 3,800 feet. There's never snow. And so when you go down, so often you're above the clouds. It's kind of like San Francisco, Mount Tamalpais. Does anyone know? Yeah. If you go up Mount Tamalpais, you're above the clouds. But then when you drive down, you have to drive through that. So it was this intense fog sometimes driving, which was terrifying as well. And people drive in such a chaotic, terrifying way that it's doubly terrifying. But if you just, you know, and my husband was actually pretty cool about the driving. He was just following the white line, you know, going slowly, and he had his lights on, which didn't really help, but at least other cars could see you coming, and just following the white line. And it was okay, you know. As long as you did that, you were okay. Hoping that other people were doing the same thing. And we're not coming too quickly behind, you know. And then just, you know, like, okay, that's what it is. But it was super, super tense during that hour or so of driving in the fog. And so then that again was another situation where you think, wow, you know, my reaction to the conditions, so much conditions, how I experience the conditions. I'm, you know, often not just present. I'm caught up with however I am interpreting things, or, you know, the projections I'm making about it. So if you're in this thick fog in the mountains and you're, of course, projecting all kinds of things. I'm sitting in the back seat with my mala reciting the Enmeijuku Karekyo, you know. Whereas if you just do it, you just follow the white line. It's okay. So, this was like applied Zen practice. Concretely applied Zen practice. And also when you're taken out of, as we also know, all of us, when you're taken out of your habitual surroundings, everything is different anyway, you know? And so you're confronted with, you're shaken out of your habitual ways of doing things and seeing things, and that can also be anxiety-ridden. It can be very exciting. It can be destabilizing. It can be eye-opening. You know, all kinds of different things we can experience. And then when you come back, like I came back, and today I was just observing. I went out, you know, just basic things to the pharmacy, to Monoprix, you know, just basic stuff. And I was like overwhelmed by the incredible luxury in which we live and that we don't even think about. And where I live is not particularly a luxurious part of the city, you know. But even that, just incredible luxury. Even just the infrastructures and the storefronts and the cafes, everything is just rich compared to a lot of what I was living with day to day in a much more disadvantaged country. And so the contrast also is something that's interesting to experience. You know, we experience light differently because we experience dark. And so the contrast heightens the experience. You know, if you're in a dark room and you turn on a flashlight, there's a huge contrast and you experience it differently. Or you come in out of the sunlight and you go into a dark room, you can't really see right away. You have to kind of adjust to the differences. And if we hang on to the light, we don't see the dark. And if we hang on to the dark, we don't see the light. So, any questions, reflections?
Two things are coming up. one thing and two situations that I was confronted to. I hear what you're saying about being present and not being caught up with ideas. And I was facing two situations recently where there was the question of being present to what was present, what was real for me, and then the question of how to respond and what my question was in those two situations, what is appropriate? What is appropriate also that includes being present to all the conditions also. One situation was being at a wedding last week of a good friend of mine, and I was very hurt because I wasn't, neither me or our other good friends were his witness. And the question was, would we talk? Would we say a word? And I said, no, I won't, I'm not going to say anything. And then his two witnesses that he took, they will do a speech. That's the kind of tradition. And they didn't. And so there were like speeches for her, but no speech for him. So there was one guy who was saying, you know, you have to speak. You have to say something. I mean, you're his friend. You have, and he just, it's ridiculous that there was no speech for him. I was kind of, so the being present part was I'm hurt and I don't want to do it, and then I also could see that it wasn't fair and it was kind of unbalanced and it was probably hurtful for him and something. And so I was thinking, what's appropriate? And then I went to see the guy and I said, are you going to speak, the witness? And he said, oh, no, I don't like to speak in public. I said, but it's not about you. And he says, no, I told him that I wouldn't speak. I was like, okay, that's not very nice. And I was like, okay, well, I'll just speak. Because that felt appropriate. But, you know, the thing is, I was really, like, for half an hour, I was like, what is appropriate? It's not appropriate to speak before him, but if he really doesn't speak, then maybe someone should speak, and if someone should speak, then that's probably me and another friend, his two oldest friends. And yesterday I was at a wedding, at a funeral, and the same thing happened, and I said to the my friend, I said, are you going to speak? And she said, no, I won't. It's too much for me, I can't. It was her mother. And then there's like the little girl that spoke, and then the old friend, and then that was it. It was like two people speaking. I was like, oh, that's kind of sad, actually. And I was like, okay, is it appropriate? What's appropriate? And it didn't seem appropriate for me to speak.
Did you know the woman, the mother?
Oh, very well, yeah, very well. It was like I've known her for 20 years, and I was very moved. But it, at that moment, I was like, okay, it would feel appropriate for me to, I would love to speak, but it didn't feel appropriate because just, I'm not the first circle, I'm not part of the family, I'm not, and because none of those people were speaking, and just, and they didn't, she didn't ask me to speak also or to officiate or anything, so it didn't feel appropriate. Mm. So like being present and at the same time it's like that question of what is appropriate without being caught with my own desires or my own hurt of not being chosen for something or
it sounds like that's the key in these two situations. It's like you said to your friend, it's not about you,
right?
So maybe in the first situation you, like you said, it felt appropriate because you saw that you were hurt and...
I saw my hurt, but I thought it's not about my hurt either.
Exactly, and you overcame that.
And I overcame, and I overcame, and I... and actually, funny, because I did speak about anger in that speech also. Just this is what came up. But like anger as a... Because it just happens that I didn't talk about my anger. I talked about anger in general and how... That helps also to make peace, to see it, like to recognize it, to be present to it. Mm. And to, because my friend was not the type of people that was saying things, and he found a woman that kind of pushed him into that direction. I was like, oh, this is good. Something is happening for you that is a really, it's good that you're saying things, and sometimes it's not really pleasant for other people, but peace, it's, you'll learn that, and you'll learn that that's the key for, for, you know, for a peaceful relationship, to speak, to recognize, to witness, to. But it's really hard to. I find it very, it needs, it's a real skill to see what is appropriate, and in order to see it, it also requires to be present to the ingredients that that are happening around. And it's, it, so I was like really just spent a lot of time in that situation, and it's like, and also recognizing my pain, my me being hurt, and overcoming this, and letting go of that for him, and knowing what's the most important, and but like two situations and two outcomes also,
different, right, because outcomes, different situations,
because different situation,
yeah.
And then what I felt saying at that funeral, I said it to privately to my friend, and that felt appropriate. But I don't know if I was right. I don't know, you know, but this is what felt appropriate.
And that, that's Bernie Glassman's three tenets of not knowing, bearing witness, and then acting. It's exactly that. So you have to forget everything you know about the situation, you know, which includes your, whatever you're hurt, or whatever you, how you think it should be, or how it shouldn't be, or being, you know, that guy should be speaking, or why isn't anyone speaking? It's terrible that no one's speaking at this woman's funeral, or whatever. You know, it's not very nice, whatever. Forget all of it, and then just bear witness to whatever the situation is, which sounds like you did, and you could see that, no, the appropriate action was, your, the appropriate action was to just say it to the woman individually instead of saying it in front of, sounds like it. Another applied Zen. Yeah. And it, but it is hard to, the not knowing aspect is really hard. That's why Bernie designed plunges, because when you're plunged into situations that are so extreme, your usual points of reference are lost.
And what are the plunges?
You know, he does different ones, street retreats, retreats at Auschwitz. There's a retreat at Pine Ridge, you know, on the Indian reservations, Wounded Knee.
Any type of situation that would put you in an unknown situation and kind of shattering, that shatters your understanding and your grounds and foundations. And
it's beyond comprehension. You know, you go to Auschwitz and it's just beyond comprehension. Like, how can that, how can this be? You know? And everything you've thought about it, well, when you're there for 5 days, 24/7, you know, it's different. Your experience of it's different. You plunge. And that's what living in the street for a street retreat is. They did one in Rwanda, Bosnia. In Israel and Palestine. So these different situations like that, that are intense. And you, that helps to lose your points of reference and therefore open to not knowing what the situation is, and then you can just bear witness to it in a different way. And then know what the appropriate action is.
Yeah, I was thinking about the idea of, like, getting outside of the stories that you tell yourself, you know, the narrative, like, okay, so this is the way this situation goes, and I am this character, and they're that character, and Auschwitz means this, and, you know, at a wedding, you only speak if you are this, and, you know, kind of, you go in with, like, this very narrow little framework. And you can only see, if you stay with that framework, you can only see things through that. I am someone who sometimes gets vertigo. I am not my son's age. Therefore, I should not be on this path. Or, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I find even sometimes with people in my life who I struggle with, like I will say to myself, this is the way our relationship is, and this is what's hard about it, or this is what they always do, and this is what I do, and here's my role, here's their role, here's, you know, and then sometimes you really are surprised by how things are when you see the person or whatever it is, or how you feel, or how, you know, it's so easy to believe the story instead of thinking, oh, we're all changing characters all the time, and the plot is changing all the time, and who knows
it's just
what
a story.
This experience
yeah.
will be like. That's just one story.
Yeah. Yeah, at Auschwitz it was interesting because there was a Vietnam veteran who was there who had become a Zen monk. And after a few days there, he said to us, because everyone was, we were sitting on the train tracks, you know, where the selections were meant, and we were visiting the ruins of the barracks and the ovens and all of this stuff. And the execution wall, of course, because there was a wall where people were shot. And so he said, when you go to the execution wall, instead of and everyone would go stand against the wall, you know, and try to feel what that would have felt like. And he said, when you go to the execution wall, instead of standing against the wall, go stand in the place where the executioner stood, where the firing squad stood. And he said, when you're out walking among the barracks and on the track, just look up to the guard towers. Just look. And it was really interesting to see how it was so moving to see how that changed then, because as you say, we have our perspective. We were very much identified with the victims when we go to Auschwitz. And we see it as the victims are the ones who were herded there in cattle cars and put into the ovens or executed. And we tend to just think of the guards and the people who run the camp as bad guys, kind of like in an American movie where they're just bad and have no depth except evil and not really see, which was something that's very powerful at Auschwitz, is you see that you have the executioner in you as well. Not that all of us would run a concentration camp and herd 6 million Jews to their death, but we do it to ourselves. You know, we do the triage in ourselves of things we like about ourselves and things we don't like. We try to eliminate the things we don't like, and we do it with other people, like you say, you know, so I have this person who's giving me a hard time and I want to eliminate this person, or I want to eliminate that aspect of myself or that aspect of that person. It's what Bernie calls the yucky piles. You know, kids, like little kids, when they're eating, you know, they push all the peas to the side of the plate because they don't want them, or the yucky pile. Homeless people, you know. People with AIDS. Refugees. You know, everything that's outcast in our culture, we put into a yucky pile. But we also do that to ourselves and in our lives. So that's, as you say, that's just another, we look through our frame of reference all the time. It's almost like those things, I don't know if they still exist, but when I was a kid, what did they call it? Viewmaster or something? And you could put in that, like it was a round circle with little images on it, and you'd look through
that. I remember that.
Remember, wasn't it called the Viewmaster or something? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they had that when you were little too?
Yeah.
What a weird thing, huh? Yeah. But you only saw that image, you know, and then you moved on and you could only see it in this place, you know. And I have this feeling, like now I'm thinking about it, I probably saw like images of the Andes and the Indians in the Andes. And when you go there, the people, they really look like that, but it's a completely different experience than when you're just looking in this little thing like this. So yeah, the frames of reference are. And that's what plunges are for, to help us to shatter those frames of reference. But if you do this practice a lot, you know, if you do this seriously, sit and let things arise and not interfere, then you have a better chance of loosening your grip on that frame of reference in daily situations like Joa describes. You know, he didn't need a plunge to go into it like that, because he's used to sitting and letting things arise and seeing when he's caught by attachments or when he's projecting things onto the situation. So
I have to say, I was angry for weeks before that.
And before what? Before
going to the wedding.
Oh, I see.
I was very angry. I was very upset that he didn't even come to me and said, you know, I can understand. It wasn't even about me. It was none of our... He picked like a guy that he this guy was my witness at my own wedding. And he picked a guy that he got to know like 6 months before the wedding. So it was... What? So, and until the very end, I just didn't know if I would do it. And the funny thing
if you
is...
You would go into the wedding?
No, if I would speak.
Oh, okay.
It's just at the moment, it was like, okay, let's just do it. So, it's funny also that, I mean, what I meant is like, it took a while also to let it go. But that moment of let it go happened at the moment where I had to let it go. It's like, because it had to be done at that precise moment.
Mm.
I couldn't... There was only one moment where the speech could have been done. Otherwise, I mean, afterwards, before it would have been totally inappropriate or not possible. And if you do it after the wedding, it's just doesn't exist anymore. It's over. So it was also interesting to notice that, you know, I was still kind of... And the funniest part was that there was a guy at my table who was even more upset than I was. He wasn't friends with him. He was like, he wasn't a good friend of him, but he was like, this is absurd. Like, the witness is not doing the speech. I mean, this is like, what an asshole. And he was very, you have to do it. And he was like more upset than I was.
I didn't know that the witnesses were supposed to speak at the wedding.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's the tradition.
Well,
that's
they're like the best man.
Yeah. I guess, yeah. I mean,
right?
The best man, yeah. The
yeah.
witness,
so
the best man.
That's what we say,
yeah,
the
yeah.
best man. And,
the best
yeah.
man, sorry, not the witness.
Yeah.
The best man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's
so
it.
So first it's the best man, then eventually parents, and then the friends that might do something, but...
It's the best man who gives a speech.
Yeah, if the best man doesn't give a speech, you're not going to come up and it's like, okay, you know.
Depends on cultures. Also.
That's true.
Yeah, but in that context, again, what felt appropriate. If I was in Quito, I would have probably just like, oh, I have no idea how that works,
right.
And I would have observed.
Yeah.
But and on top of that, they were doing something very traditional. So I was like,
mm-hmm.
okay, well, we're just going to follow the procedure. I mean, this is what is appropriate here.
Right.
But the point is, yeah, it's true that maybe I was completely off. Maybe I was completely wrong. Maybe. Like you feel that it's appropriate, but maybe it's completely inappropriate. it's difficult to know.
Did your friend who got married, did he thank you?
Yes. And his wife was super pleased, and he said, yeah, it was very good that you did it, and it's great what you said. And
yeah,
yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
But and the same, it's also true, appropriate is not black or white, you know, it's like...
Mm-hmm.
What's appropriate? Yeah. Depends. But you have a better chance of feeling that something is appropriate if you're not fixed on your position. So, you know, if you let go of all of that stuff and then, yeah, it does feel appropriate to do this, then then it's okay. And maybe there were some people who are really attached to the form and everything and who thought, who is this guy talking? He's not, he shouldn't be talking.
Yeah.
You know? You know, he's not the best man. He's not the witness. Why is he talking? So hold on. That's our life, wherever we are. wherever, whenever. It's always the same, because it's always different. Okay.